this is a lesson for believers. We cannot keep others in dark, even for good motives. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing some lessons for believers in order to live a life that can be accounted and amounted for as a life of a believer. What is it that we're supposed to do? Well, one of the things is supporting the truth. Do you see that truth has been replaced by falsehood? We must be prepared to sacrifice everything that is precious in support of truth. And again, the infallible Imam has encouraged us to do that. And this is what I read in one of the books where Imam clearly instructed his followers that for haq, for truth, don't be afraid to sacrifice anything you have. Truth is the essence of Islam and fortifies the values emphasized in the Holy Quran. If you look at Hazrat Ali Akbar, who is the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he asked his father, "Are we not on the right path?" The Imam replied in affirmative. And then, what did Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salam said? He said, "Then it makes no difference if death comes to us or if we approach death." See, today we see in the world when the Zionist regime, it attacks the oppressed nation of Palestine, the believers, those who have faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they rise, they get up, and they fight for their rights. They fight for what is truth and haq. They fight against falsehood. Now, the question is, were they not giving sacrifices through this action? Well, of course they were. But these sacrifices are well worth it. This is in line with the teachings of Islam, where you sacrifice all you have for the rightful implementation of what is haq and truth. So with this, you know, we need to take lesson from the lives of infallibles where, we can live a life of a believer. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
A new analysis by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, concludes that Israeli regime's attack displays a pattern of international law violations. Al-Haq argues that the violations amount to war crimes, says Esra Saleh Al-Nami, journalist, in an article titled "When Israeli regime killed doctors." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Dr. Ayman Abu Al-Auf had finished a busy shift. He wrapped it up by checking on patients with COVID-19 in the intensive care unit of Al-Shafa Hospital. As head of internal medicine at the hospital, he was acutely aware that the pandemic had not been paused. Rather, the number of coronavirus infections remained high, even though Gaza was in the news internationally due to another emergency, a large-scale Israeli regime attack. Not long after he got home from work, the building where Abu Alaf lived was bombed without warning. He, his wife Reem, and two of their children, Tawfiq and Tala, were killed. So were both his parents and many members of his extended family. Dr. Qawla Nasser was a colleague of Ayman Abu Al-Auf. She had accompanied him as he checked on patients that evening. He left the hospital to get some rest after a long day, said Nasser. It was a big shock to hear that he was then brought back to the hospital a few hours later as a dead body. It has taken us a long time to absorb that terrible news. Abu Al-Auf was popular. He had taught numerous medical students over the years. He was fond of organizing seminars to discuss advances in medicine. Patients appreciated his dedication and diligence. When I told him that I would buy the expensive medicine I needed, he would not hear of it, said one woman who had cancer and then a stroke. He did everything possible to ensure I could get the medicine free of charge, the woman said. On the condition of anonymity, adding, he was a kind man. Abu Al-Auf was among two doctors killed during the early hours of May 16th, when the Israeli regime committed a massacre in the area surrounding Gaza City's Al-Wehda Street. The other was Dr. Moin Al-Alul, a neurologist. Moin's 25-year-old daughter, Aya, recalled that she had been terrified in moments leading up to the massacre as Gaza had been under intense bombardment. She had gone into her parents' bedroom to seek a little solace. Suddenly, I found myself covered with rubble, she said. The first thing I did was to shout out my parents' names. My mom heard me and said, I am here. I asked her about my dad. She didn't tell me that he was dead. She didn't want me to lose consciousness, Aya added. People came and dug me and my mom out of the rubble. Soon as I arrived at the hospital, I knew that my dad had been killed. Moin Al-Alul had run several clinics across Gaza. My father went to great lengths so that he could help people, said Aya. On many occasions, he asked patients to pray for him rather than pay him. He was a doctor who people trusted a lot. More than 40 people were killed in the Al-Wehda Street massacre. The Israeli regime's bombardment left a large crater in a road leading to Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical facility. Ambulances were impeded from traveling to and from the hospital as a consequence. It was one of many incidents that had a direct impact on health services in Gaza during last month's attack. Among the facilities destroyed or damaged were Gaza's only testing center for COVID-19, two Palestinian Red Crescent ambulance stations, and a clinic caring for mothers and infants. A new analysis by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, concludes that the Israeli regime's attack displays a pattern of international law violations. Al-Haq argues that the violations amount to war crimes. The Rome Statutes, under which the International Criminal Court was established, forbids attacks against a civilian population and the destruction of civilian infrastructure. Many of Gaza's doctors have paid tribute to the two doctors killed during the massacre on Al-Wahda Street. In one tribute, their colleagues walked from Al-Shifa Hospital to the site of the buildings which the Israeli regime bombed. A section of Al-Shifa has been named in Ayman Abu Al-Af memory. "We have just done our little bit to remember the two doctors," said Dr. Muhammad Abu Selmia, Al-Shifa's director. "We believe that the best thing we can do for them is to follow the examples they set. That means taking good care of patients." This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace, blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to talk about, or let's say answer, some doubts or misconceptions on the important issue of Mahdaviya or Mahdism. For this, we have invited, as usual, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to answer our questions that we pose here. The question that we want to ask from his presence is about the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the events that will happen after his reappearance. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Many thanks, Sheikh, for accepting the invitation to the show. The first question and the question of the day that I want to ask you from you, Sheikh, is about the time that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappears. And it is being said that after his reappearance, he will destroy and ruin the house of God, the Kaaba, and Masjid al-Haram. Is it true, Sheikh? And if yes, what is the source? If not, what is the root, or what are the roots of such doubts?
As you mentioned, it's been raised, this doubt, by some of the Wahhabi scholars. They have referred to one narration in Shia sources, and they have claimed that Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, when he comes, he will destroy Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi in Mecca and Medina, and will destroy the Kaaba, and of course will rebuild them. I mean Masjid al-Haram, Kaaba, and Masjid al-Nabi, and will put them on their original place. Mm-hmm. Now, when we refer to the source, it is true, we have...
So it's not destruction, Sheikh, in the sense that you're talking about. It's sort of rebuilding.
Exactly. This is one of the points that we want to emphasize, that even if it will happen, it would be because of rebuilding, not just destroying.
Or reconstruction.
Exactly, reconstruction. But first of all, this narration, based on the chain of the narration, is a weak narration. It's been mentioned in Kitab al-Ghiba, page 472. But the chain of the narration is not authentic, so we can say that we can get rid of this doubt and question altogether. But let's analyze the content of the narration and see if it is true or not. The first point is that we see that it's been mentioned in some of the narrations in Sunni sources that the Holy Prophet wished to destroy Kaaba and reconstruct it again. Mm-hmm. Because we know that after being built by Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, and even before that, Kaaba has gone through different changes during the history. It's been, in some cases, destroyed a part of it and reconstructed again. I don't want to say that these narrations are true or not, but the point is that this Wahhabi scholar refers to one weak Shia narration to claim that Mahdi will destroy the Kaaba, but the point is that it's been mentioned in Sunni sources as well as a wish of the Prophet. Let me share one narration, for example. It's been mentioned in Sahih Bukhari, volume 2, page 156, Sahih Muslim, volume 4, page 97, and many other Sunni sources. In one narration, Aisha narrates that the Holy Prophet once told me, Hatim, which is referring to Hijr Ismail, and we know that today Hijr Ismail is outside the Kaaba, it's not inside mm-hmm. the Kaaba.
That's true.
Now, according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, Hijr Ismail is and was a part of Kaaba, but for some reasons, they put it outside the Kaaba. And because of the fact that these Arabs are very close to the era of Jahiliyyah, I wish to destroy Kaaba and reveal the columns which were built by Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam and put Hajr Ismail inside the Kaaba.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Holy Prophet concludes, if I be alive for another year, I will do that. Again, I don't want to say that it is a true narration, authentic narration or not. But it's been mentioned, for example, in Asirat al-Halabiyya, volume 1, page 288.
Yeah.
And Ibn al-Kathir, the famous Sunni scholar, after narrating this narration, says that this narration has been mentioned in different books of hadith by Sunni scholars from Aisha. It's in Al-Bidayah wal-Nihayah, volume 8, page 289. So you see, according to this narration, the Holy Prophet also wanted to destroy the Kaaba and rebuild it and reconstruct it based on the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim a.s. So it's weird to attribute that to Imam Mahdi a.s. and consider it a weak point for Imam Mahdi a.s. This is not the case. This has been a wish of the Prophet according to this narration.
By this doubt that this person actually has brought up, the thing that comes to the mind of a listener of such quotes is that he's coming just to destroy it, not to, as you said, not to rebuild and reconstruct it. I think it is good to be to enlighten the brothers and sisters who are listening to us. This is not actually in the sense to destroy it, to say that there is no, exactly, from now on there is not going to be any Masjid al-Haram. No. In case, even if this weak narration, as you said, and you talked about the credentials and also authentication of the hadith, in case, in, let's say, suppose the impossible, it is true, then it has nothing to do with the destruction at all. It is sort of reconstruction is going to happen. Thank you, Sheikh.
It is interesting to know that it's been mentioned by one of the Sunni scholars called Sarakhsi that this narration of the Prophet was so famous that at the time of Abdullah ibn Zubayr, he wanted to act upon this prophetic narration. So he revealed those columns built by Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and he put Hijr Ismail inside the Kaaba. This is the report of Sarakhsi. But when Abdullah ibn Zubayr was killed, Hajjaj, who was unhappy with this act of ibn Zubayr, again destroyed that part and put the Kaaba as it is right now. This is in Al-Mabsud, volume 4, page 11. As Shia, can we say that you see the Sunnis wanted to damage the Holy Kaaba and destroy Masjid al-Haram? No, this is not the case. We are not doing that by referring to these narrations in Sunni sources. As you mentioned, even if these narrations are true, they are referring to the fact that the Holy Prophet wanted to rebuild it based on the tradition and the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. And if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do so again, it is because of rebuilding the Kaaba. This is the first point.
Very true.
The second point again is that destroying Masjid al-Haram or Masjid al-Nabi might be first because of going back to the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. And secondly, maybe because of the extension, maybe Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to extend the limits of Masjid al-Haram, for example. We can conclude this point from some narrations, which tell us that at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, Masjid al-Haram was larger and bigger than Masjid al-Haram that we have today. For example, in a narration in Al-Kafi, volume 4, page 209, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, "Inna Ibrahim wa Ismail hadda al-Masjid al-Haram ma bayna al-Safa wal-Marwa." At the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, the limits of Masjid al-Haram was between Safa and Marwa. And we know that today is much smaller than this. So we can argue that maybe one of the reasons that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to destroy Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi is because of the fact that he is going to extend the limits of the mosque and taking back to the structure and limits at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam.
Shaykhana, by the limits, you mean the Baytullah itself or the whole masjid?
The whole masjid.
Okay. So can this new development plan that Saudi Arabia is doing, can be regarded as that?
They are not doing that because of the fact that they know about the limits of Masjid al-Haram at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhim as-salam. They are doing that because of some of the reforms, because of the population, and so on and so forth. But what Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do, if these narrations are authentic, is out of his divine knowledge. Mm-hmm. He knows, because of his divine knowledge about the limits at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhim as-salam, and will rebuild, especially Masjid al-Haram, based on the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. So apparently, I mean, seemingly they are the same, but what Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do, if these narrations are authentic, is out of divine knowledge, mm-hmm. which at the end we will have Masjid al-Haram exactly like the one, and the Kaaba like the one at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam.
Thank you very much.
Wherever you be, cause you're the one my heart is to need you.
And the last point that I would like to share is the fact that some of these narrations referring to the destroying Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi, they also refer to the Mosque of Kufa. Now the point is that we know that the Mosque of Kufa is a symbol for Shia school of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam wanted, and the Shia narrations wanted to claim that Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi will be destroyed, why the Mosque of Kufa has been mentioned in such narrations as well? Because the Mosque of Kufa is a symbol of only Shia school of thought. So we can, as you mentioned, we can conclude that the intention of these Wahhabi scholars referring to these narrations is not a good intention,
mm-hmm.
because they want to portray this act as a kind of anti-Islamic deed by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But when we see that, according to some narrations, the Mosque of Kufa also will be damaged, the conclusion is that the intention of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is a good one. Maybe he wants to extend the limits of the Mosque of Kufa, also like the Mosque of, Masjid al-Nabi in Medina and Masjid al-Haram in the city of Mecca. There are some narrations in this regard. For example, according to Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam,
mm-hmm.
Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will go to the city of Kufa. He will order people to destroy the Mosque of Kufa, حتى يبلغ أساسها, so that the structure goes back to its original one. Again, I don't want to say that whether these narrations are authentic or not. The point is that the intention of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, if these narrations are true, is taking back all these holy places to their original ones.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. So the gist of your explanations and presentation is that first and foremost, this hadith is weak. Secondly, in case it is true, so it has nothing to do with destruction, rather it's a sort of reconstruction with the intention of the extension of the limits of these masjids. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
What?
the limelight.
As anyone who has experienced middle age will know, the process of growing old can be extremely hard on the body. Your bones begin to leak calcium, your muscles begin to shrivel, the immune system weakens, and arthritis can set in. Poor posture and balance affect how you move about the world, while cataracts and deteriorating eyesight impair how you see it. Heart problems and declining cognitive function eventually set in as people approach the end of their lives. These symptoms, however, can also be caused by something less common, space travel. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Shi and Kim, a commentator and writer under the heading, "To Study Aging, Scientists Are Looking to Outer Space." Spaceflight influences biology in dramatic ways, and people in space appear to experience the effects of aging faster than people on Earth. Now scientists have gained a better understanding of space travel's influence on living beings than ever before. A slew of 29 papers recently published in the journals Cell Reports, iScience, Cell Systems, and Patterns examined the biological hazards of spaceflight in 56 astronauts. More than 10% of all the people who have ever been to space. The new studies bring us a step closer to identifying the mechanisms underpinning the biological responses to living in space. More than 200 scientists demonstrated that space upends the genes, mitochondrial function, and chemical balances in the cells to trigger a cascade of broader health effects in spacefaring humans and animals. Susan Bailey, a radiologist at Colorado State University who participated in multiple of the new studies, says the entire body is affected because space is such a different and extreme environment. The health effects associated with spaceflight have several similarities to aging-related disorders such as cancer and osteoporosis. While spaceflight's parallels to aging are a concern for long-term crewed missions, such as those that will be required on a voyage to Mars, the unique space environment also presents a unique opportunity to study the physiology of aging. It's estimated that the heart, blood vessels, bones and muscles deteriorate more than 10 times faster in space than by natural aging. This means to study the aging process, scientists don't have to wait for their biological subjects to naturally mature on Earth. They can harness the accelerated health effects by running experiments on the International Space Station, the ISS. Scientists stress that the symptoms of space travel aren't exactly the same as aging, and many changes reverse themselves once people return to Earth. But the comparisons are still useful. Spaceflight is an immersive experience that spares no traveler, while aging happens to every Earthling, whether we like it or not. As such, life in space is a good model for understanding aging as a chronic process, Bailey says. The barren otherworld of outer space could even reveal new ways to protect ourselves against the process of growing old. All life on our planet has evolved under Earth's gravity and conditions, so we aren't optimized for living in any other kind of environment. Space affects different cells in different ways, says Michael Roberts, interim chief scientist of the International Space Station National Laboratory. He says, it's not a single acute exposure to toxic agents, for example. It's something that's long-term, chronic, and persistent. Living in space resets the body's equilibrium levels for functioning optimally, he adds, thereby rebooting the physiological norms of how cells respond. In microgravity, the heart, bones, and muscles don't need to toil as hard as they do back on Earth, so they languish from disuse. Liquids flow differently in space, and this may change the shapes of fluid-filled tissues, such as those in the brain. The higher background radiation beyond Earth's atmosphere may also damage DNA and increase the risk of cancer. Even the slightly higher carbon dioxide levels on the International Space Station ISS can throw off an astronaut's physiology. The new research on the health effects of spaceflight echoes the findings of a previous comprehensive health profiling of NASA twin astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly. The NASA twins study involved 10 research teams monitoring the molecular and physiological changes that Scott experienced during and after a year-long sojourn in space. The researchers compared the changes to Scott's identical twin, Mark, who stayed earthbound during this time. From over 300 biological samples, the teams catalogued a series of bodily differences in the twin astronauts, including changes to the astronauts' genes expressions, microbiomes, cognitive functions, and vascular systems. In the twin study, Bailey made a striking discovery. Scott's telomeres changed in length. Telomeres plug the end of chromosomes to protect them from damage, much like the plastic caps that prevent shoelaces from fraying. They are a good indicator for aging, Bailey says, because their length are affected by all aspects of earthly living, from our diet to our lifestyle and even our mental well-being. Telomeres shorten as we age, and how quickly our telomeres shorten is an important marker of health. During Scott's time in space, scientists observed an unexpected overall lengthening of his telomeres. When he returned to Earth, however, his telomeres rapidly shrunk. Even though they were longer during spaceflight, he still ended up with shorter telomeres than he started with, Bailey says. Altered telomeres length has been associated with things like cardiovascular disease, particularly short telomeres, she adds. However, Scott's elongated telomeres during his time in space isn't a good sign either. Longer telomeres are also associated with cancer. You really can't win the game. As revealing as the twin study was, it only had a sample size of one. Scott Kelly measured against the control participant in his twin brother Mark. Now researchers are confirming the study's findings, including telomere changes, by examining dozens of astronauts who have spent months in space. Like in the twin study, the researchers recorded a suite of physiological changes and attempted to identify the mechanisms, such as specific proteins or genes, that caused them. Some of the symptoms of spaceflight seem to stabilize after a certain amount of time in orbit, such as decreased blood volume and changes in the heart and lungs. But astronauts haven't lived on the International Space Station ISS long enough for scientists to say for sure that these changes to the body will ultimately reach a steady state. We've now got some foundational studies, Bailey notes, but it's still a little too early to say. Space is also a fitting environment for scientists to test drug candidates associated with aging. In a recent study, one research team at pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly tested whether an antibody drug could prevent muscle loss in mice on the International Space Station, ISS. The group liberates space's biologically stressful environment to induce muscle atrophy resembling aging and cancer. According to retired Eli Lilly cellular biologist Rosamund Smith, who led the research, in space the whole body of the animal is under the effects of microgravity. An analogous aging experiment on Earth would involve raising mice in a weightless environment by suspending their hind limbs with slings, or simply waiting for the mice to grow old. But artificial aging methods on Earth don't provide a full body experience to age all the body's muscles at once, Smith says. The Eli Lilly researchers confirmed that space indeed shrinks and weakens the muscles of the mice living on the International Space Station, matching previous observations in astronauts. Injecting the antibody drug into the mice preserved the mice's muscles. Such drugs could counter microgravity's pernicious effects on astronauts during longer crewed missions and be used as therapeutics back on Earth. It's amazing how widespread the effects of microgravity are on the human system, Smith says. There's a benefit to understanding and using space to help us learn about human physiology and therefore human disease. Scientists are also shifting to a new research platform that models human physiology better than animals, tissue chips. These USB stick-sized gadgets contain chambers and channels of cells bathed in liquid sustenance. Tissue chips typically host a concoction of cells representative of a particular human organ. Fluid flow in the chips is able to reproduce the body's inner shear and stretch forces, and a chip's interior walls provide anchor sites for cells to arrange and grow on. Essentially, tissue chips behave like a microcosm of the internal human body.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
The Saudis waged the Yemen war during the Democratic administration of Obama. The war actually began with the U.S.'s green light. The U.S. sanctioned the war and helped the Saudis. They gave the Saudis numerous military resources. To what end? In order to make the people of Yemen surrender in the course of 15 days? 1 month? After having dropped so many bombs on them? Well, they made a mistake. They have not managed to do it in the past 6 years. The war against Yemen began on such a day. 6 years have passed from that day. But they have not managed to force the Yemenis to surrender. I wish to put this question to the Americans. The day when you gave the Saudis the green light to enter into the Yemen war, did you know in what quagmire the Saudis would get stuck? You knew into what quagmire you were dragging the Saudis, as in the present time. They can neither stay nor leave. The problem has two facets for the Saudis in the present time. They can neither stop the war nor continue it. Both options of the issue are detrimental to them. Did you Americans know what disaster you were creating for the Saudis? If you knew it, and you did it anyway, then how poor your allies are, because you treat them like that, and if you did not know it, then again how poor your allies are for trusting you and for coordinating their plans with you, who are not familiar with regional issues. Therefore, you should know that you do not know the region and regional nations, and that you are making a mistake. I hope that Allah the Exalted guides all the ignorant in the world out of their ignorance and makes them turn back from their mistakes. I hope that Allah the Exalted will make the Iranian nation dearer and more powerful on a daily basis, that He will help them benefit from the comforts of life more than ever, and that He will render them happy and blissful. I hope that God will improve their worldly and otherworldly conditions. I hope that the holy heart of the Imam of the age will be satisfied with the people of Iran, and that all our people, including this humble person, will benefit from the prayers of that great Imam. I hope that the immaculate soul of our magnanimous Imam and the pure souls of martyrs will be satisfied and pleased with us. Greeting be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
live reporters.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique, as the president said when President Moon visited. The animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not, and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Gharibabadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homolesky, Vienna.
After a raucous first debate, the second presidential showdown was quiet, where candidates focused on laying out their agenda and maintained a respectful tone, even when criticizing each other. With social affairs taking central stage, the debate tested the contenders' capability to address the country's social issues, such as health, education, and poverty.
Currently, there are some 7 million heads of household in our country that depend on charities to make ends meet. We need to set up a fund that ensures a sustainable income for these people.
To fight corruption, we need to fight unfair wealth distribution
We need to pay equal attention to the less privileged stratum of society.
If I am elected president, I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way, we can help promote justice.
While the three-hour debate focused on social issues, journalists who waited outside the debate studio had other questions to ask, as the candidates got out one by one for a brief Q&A session. I was curious to know how each of the candidates would address regional issues, both politically and economically.
We are seriously pursuing close ties with our neighbors. Our region offers a 500 million strong market to us. But with regards to security issues, I have always stressed that the measures taken by late General Qasem Soleimani have turned Iran into a regional power. We have acted very well in the military field and diplomacy. But what's important is to build a bridge through the military field and diplomacy to expand our economic ties with our neighbors.
As oil-rich Iran is exploring ways to reduce dependence on the fluctuating oil market, this topic was among the FAQs, with journalists asking the candidates about what alternative economic engines they would employ to run the economy.
I will turn Iran into a food hub in the region. To this end, we will need more water and farmlands. We can expand our agricultural cooperation with other countries, especially those in Africa, which has so far been neglected.
To maintain impartiality, the national television, also known as the IRIB, has arranged every step of the debate based on a lottery system, from the order of the candidates' entrance to the IRIB to the questions posed to them, and even their seats, are determined randomly. Candidates will face off for the last time on Saturday in the third debate. This time, the content of what the candidate said might be what the Iranian public remembers from the debate. Now the seven rivals have one more chance to stand out and woo more public support in the third and final debate, slated for June 12th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there is good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.